You're heading south of the Mason-Dixon. This is the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. Here is your host, Brian McClanahan.
Welcome back to the Week in Review at the Abbeville Institute. This is your host, Brian McClanahan, and this is episode 86, covering the week of August 25th, 2017. Glad to have you back on the program. Glad to be here. Before we get started, just want to remind you of a few things. If you do like this podcast and you like our content, please share our content around on social media. And you can find the Abbeville Institute on social media. If you go to Facebook, you can like us there at Abbeville Institute. You can follow us on Twitter at Abbeville INST. And you can also subscribe to our YouTube page where we post not only this podcast, but also our videos of our lectures and other material that we have. So go on out to Abbeville Institute, just search for it on YouTube. And if you go to our webpage, abbevilleinstitute.org, you can find all the links to those social media avenues. Also, you can find our Amazon Smile icon there at the top of the page. So if you want to throw a little change our way to the Abbeville Institute, if you buy things on Amazon and you do it through our Amazon Smile account, you do help support the Institute that way. So, helping the Institute just through your normal everyday purchasing through Amazon is a great way to support the Institute without having to spend any of your own money to do it. So you can do it that way. Also, if you go to abbevilleinstitute.org and you give us an email address, we will give you a free ebook, Kirkpatrick Sales Emancipation Hell. And you will get on our email list by doing so, and you will get our daily dose of Dixie Monday through Friday and our weekly email, The Week in Review, on either Saturday or Sunday, which includes a link to this podcast, along with another article from the past, from our archive. So we've got looking at our website, over 1,000 articles on the website. So we've got a lot of material out there, a lot of material to go through, and it's a great resource. It has become a virtual online Southern library in so many different ways of Southern thought and on all topics, politics, religion, culture, music, art, food, take your pick. We also have hundreds of lectures for free. So all of those things need your support. So if you do like our mission to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition and you want to support that, you can simply go to our website at the top of the page, click on support, drop down, you'll have different membership options. But if you're an individual, you can have a membership for an individual and you can find a membership level. You can either donate monthly for as little as $3 a month if you're a student or $25 a year if you are a student. You can help us explore what's true and valuable in the Southern tradition. If you are an individual who's not a student, it's $5 a month or $50 a year, and that's the minimum. You can give more than that. If you are a business, we have business donation options and planned giving. So all of that is available on our website. If you do like our mission, please go out to social media, support us there. Also, consider a tax-deductible contribution to the Abbeville Institute. We do exist on your generous contributions alone. You can help keep this podcast going, help keep the website going, help our conferences continue to go. So all of those things, if you like that, and of course in the current climate, when people are digging up, cities are digging up Confederate bones and dumping them in lakes simply because they were Confederate soldiers, you see how important it is for a voice to be out there defending the Southern tradition, or at least exploring what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. All traditions have good and bad. We find the good, and we talk about that. And you'll see that every week on our website, and of course, every week on this particular podcast. So please consider supporting the mission of the Abbeville Institute. The future of the South and the Southern tradition really depends on it at this particular point in our modern political climate. And that said, we had a lot of great material this week. Again, the 21st to the 25th of August, 2017. I think it's one of the better weeks we've had in terms of real solid content. And particularly two pieces. The first piece for the week was written by Robert McReynolds. We also had some new authors this week. We had two new authors, Robert McReynolds and Christopher McDonald. But Robert McReynolds wrote a really interesting piece entitled "Robert E. Lee Would Have Fought the Nazis." Now, this is the charge that somehow the Confederate flag and Confederate symbols are in the same line as Nazi symbols and Nazi Germanies is so laughable. I mean, this to the World War II generation who fought the Nazis, physically fought the Nazis, that particular idea would have been so laughable. They wouldn't even have considered it. But of course, after the war is over, and after as we get 70 years from World War II, and we forget what the Nazis really were, and you look at what's happening, the political climate, and of course the climate around these protests and all the other things going on, the group of leftist protesters who are acting like real Nazis, I mean, going out and beating people up and using horrible, nasty, filthy weapons against people and other things. All of this stuff happening, not just in the South, but all over the United States. They are the real fascists. But the idea that somehow the Southern soldier in 1941 would have somehow been in support of Nazi Germany, the 1861 Southern soldier would have supported 1941 Nazi Germany, is so laughable that it wouldn't even been considered. There are many Southerners who went to war in 1941 against the Nazis carrying the Confederate flag. And, I mean, this you find pictures of it all over the place, and not just in World War II, but also in the Vietnam War and the Korean War. You have the very famous image there in the Pacific Theater where soldiers have hoisted the Confederate battle flag instead of the U.S. flag. And I mean, not like they did at Iwo Jima, but certainly they hoisted a Confederate flag as they took positions. I mean, this was an American symbol of American defiance to strong central authority. And Lee himself would have not agreed with the tactics of the Nazi government with ethnic cleansing. There was no ethnic cleansing in the South. We had a really good piece weeks ago by Clyde Wilson saying, you know, who were the Nazis? And of course, he said, look, the Northern government, if you look at their interest in the fusion of government and finance, if you look at their interest in a strong central authority, which is essentially what we got, they would, now they weren't Nazis, of course, but those things, those ideas, the fusion of the corporate entity and the state, those are fascist ideas. And so, the Jeffersonians weren't the Nazis. And there was no concerted effort on the part of the South for any type of cultural ethnic cleansing going on. But of course, Sherman did talk about the extinction of the Southern people. So who were the Nazis in 1861? Of course, Lee, the symbol that people are Lee, the Confederate symbol, Robert Lee, these people are just American Nazis. It's so laughable. What we should be doing all the time is making fun of these people for saying such stupid things instead of, kowtowing and walking around and saying, these things are, if you don't like it, if you're offended, we'll take it down. The fact is, the Southern tradition is so anti-fascist, so anti-Nazi. I mean, my gosh, there were Jewish Confederates, a large number of them. Judah P. Benjamin who was one of the highest ranking members of the Confederate cabinet, was Jewish. You had David Ewell Lee in Florida, who was Jewish. Now, he was not in the Confederate government, but he was an ardent secessionist leading up to the war. So you had a very strong Jewish Confederate faction in Charleston, for example. Charleston being the Holy City, there was so much religious toleration in Charleston, they called it the Holy City. You go down there today, and there's church after church of different denominations, because these are old churches, they aren't new, because the South tolerated differences in religion. I mean, the first real strong, what you would consider to be religious toleration legislation was passed in Virginia. And of course, Jefferson and Madison were strong proponents of that. So this whole idea that somehow the South is pro-Nazi, again, it's so silly. It shouldn't even be contemplated by Americans. But this is where we are because we have people who seem to conflate the two and seem to distort the issues by doing stupid things at rallies and other things. But the South was not pro-Nazi. The Southern tradition is not pro-Nazi. The Southern tradition is not anti-Semitic at all. And so I think that when you have stupid people in charge of government and not just that, but the stupid talking heads, this is the kind of situation you get. But I love this piece by Robert McReynolds because he points it out. Now, look, Robert E. Lee was not a Nazi, not even close. And the Southern tradition is not pro-Nazi, not even close. Again, we're in a political climate where anything we just saw, as I mentioned earlier, in the beginning of this podcast, you have in Ohio Confederate soldiers being dug up and dumped in a lake because they're simply Confederate soldiers. And people are so hypersensitive, you have at USC, University of Southern California, is renaming their horse Traveler because that was the name of Robert E. Lee's horse. Oh my gosh, that's so offensive. Or you got the Asian American Robert Lee being removed from a broadcasting job, not removed entirely from his job, but from broadcasting a football game at University of Virginia because his name is Robert Lee. Now, I guess everyone that has a last name Lee is going to be, you got to change your name. Got to change your life. Can't have a Lee. Maybe a Davis. Can't have a Davis either. A Jackson. Anyone that's last name Jackson or Calhoun, that would knock out, or Washington or Jefferson, that would knock out a large number of African Americans in the South too, who have these last names. You can't have those things. Those are just racist. So we can't have that. But this is how stupid. And people should just call it what it is: silly and stupid. They should really. When somebody mentions these things, it should just be that stupid. Are you really that stupid? I see your point. No, you're just an idiot and you're stupid. So we should start calling it for what it is: stupidity. And of course, in graduate school, that was one of Clyde Wilson's favorite things to say. This is just stupid. And it is. To somehow conflate the Nazi Germany with the Southern tradition or the Confederacy is just idiotic. Now, that said, on Tuesday we had a book book review of Clyde Wilson's Nullification, written by Christopher McDonald. If you haven't read Clyde's little book on nullification, it's worth it. It's a collection of essays that Clyde's written over the years on the issue of nullification, and of course Clyde understands it probably better than anyone else in the United States, because he worked with the John C. Calhoun papers for most of his professional career. So, to have someone like Clyde write a little book on nullification, it's a valuable resource. And again, it is a collection of essays, highly worth your time to go out and read this thing. There have been some pretty wonderful books written about nullification. Of course, you've got a modern, very strong nullification movement in the United States now in many different ways. You have a candidate running for governor of Oklahoma who is a very strong nullification candidate, and he has a real shot to win, Dan Fisher. You have the 10th Amendment Center, which is doing a very good job pushing nullification efforts across the United States in various ways. Of course, the Abbeville Institute supports this particular position as well. Anything for which is the Southern tradition, decentralization, nullification was really the American tradition. And if you look back at, you look at the colonial period, the colonies were nullifying British law when it didn't work within their long-standing custom and precedent. And this was North and South, but it happened in Virginia, it happened in Rhode Island and in New England. So this idea of nullification was born during the period leading to the American War for Independence, that the British passed a law that was unconstitutional. Well, the colonies just wouldn't follow it. Essentially, they would nullify it. And they actually passed legislation to that effect and their colonial legislatures. So this idea of nullification has been around a long time. And then, of course, Jefferson and Madison codified it in 1798 with the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. And then, of course, it was picked up across the United States in various ways throughout American history. So, but it definitely has a Southern tinge to it, particularly as it was codified and announced during the period of the early Federal Republic. This book on nullification, understanding nullification and what we're doing today and how it can be an effective tool to resist unconstitutional government. I mean, this is all that Calhoun was trying to say in his disquisition on government. The 10th Amendment is great, but it's not going to, or written constitution's great, it's preferable, but it doesn't stop unconstitutional government. So there has to be some type of mechanism in place, and the 10th Amendment has to have teeth, and if you don't have teeth, then you're going to have a worthless scrap of paper. And that was Calhoun's position overall. So I think that you should go out and read Klein's book on nullification. Kirk Wood has written a 2-volume a book on nullification. Tom Woods has written a great book on nullification. The Kennedy brothers have written a book on nullification. So there's lots of stuff out there on this now. In terms of, you know, books on nullification. And Clyde's is a nice addition to all of those particular projects. The piece on Wednesday I found to be really, really interesting. It was written by Abbeville scholar Marshall LaRosa, and it's part of a forthcoming project that he's shopping around about Confederate case law. Now, this is a virgin field. It is unplowed territory to really look at Confederate case law. There's a very old book out there about the Confederate legal system, but to actually get into the case law itself and look at the Confederate legal system and what it did is just an amazing, amazing process. It's an amazing, amazing academic and intellectual process, and much needed. And Marshall, of course, is a political science professor in Florida. And he wrote the book on the Confederate Constitution. I mean, if you want to know about the Confederate Constitution, you go out and read Marshall's book on it, because it is that good. This book, I think, when it comes out, it's going to dispel a lot of myths about the Confederacy. And the title of this particular piece was Confederate Case Law, The Rule of Law, Not of Men. And so, you know, you look at this idea that somehow, again, the Confederates were all Nazis, and they were interested in genocide and cultural cleansing, and that the rule of law disappeared in the South. You never had a rule of law. It's just so preposterous. It's not even funny. Again, it's just a stupid anti-intellectual position. And people that say that have no idea what they're talking about. For example, Nazi Germany abolished jury trial, trial by jury. The Confederacy didn't do that. In fact, this trial by jury was not only for white Southerners, but also for black Southerners. And this one of the cases that he brings up and what he outlines in this particular piece is a case where a slave was actually accused of rape. And you would think that, I heard on one of the national talk shows yesterday that, I can understand why people, they were talking about a lynching of Italian Americans in the early 20th century. And he said, well, I mean, you know, in the South, this went on for centuries with black Americans. They would just be lynched for no reason. And there was no rule of law in the South. I mean, this is, again, a stupid, uneducated, uninformed position, because nobody understands Confederate case law. And even law, you know, case law before that, when you look at the Southern states and things that were going on. So in this particular case, a slave was accused of rape, and you would think that offhand, well, he's just going to be executed for that, because he's accused by a white woman of rape. But what you find in this particular case is that he was acquitted. He was acquitted. And so this was by jury trial. And the judge essentially said, slaves in this particular case, in a case like this where it's a capital crime, deserve the same type of legal protections as white Southerners. If they are guilty, they will be punished accordingly, but they need to have all the same legal protections in place as you would for white Southerners. But you wouldn't hear that on the mainstream media, on the mainstream historical outlets, on the pundits, historians/pundits who go out and run their mouths on a regular basis and say that the Confederacy was just the Nazi Germany. I mean, this is what we have. So Marshall has just completely destroyed that in one article. And of course, there's other instances of this across the South. This was just one example he gave. But in the South, you still had the rule of law. And the other thing he brings up, of course, is that the Confederate Supreme Court was never put into effect legally. The states handled all of the caseload during the war. They never had a federal court system for the South. The states did it all. So this idea that, and I talked about this before on this podcast, in my own podcast and other places, but you know, this idea that somehow the Confederacy created a strong, the blueprint for a strong central government is just completely, again, destroyed by the entire Confederate legal system. Because the states were issuing writs of habeas corpus when the general government said you can't. They were doing it anyways. The state courts were. The states were a block, and it was always thought states' rights hindered the general government of the Confederacy in fighting the war. That states' rights were too strong, not the other way around. But, I mean, again, this is the stupid position that these neoconservatives take, also those on the left, that take that, you know, the Confederacy was just some type of, you know, the early blueprint of Nazi Germany. It's just, Hitler admired Lincoln and the Union government, not the South. He thought the South was problematic because of the situation of, you know, very strong states' rights or local constitutions and government over that of the center. So, again, it goes, McReynolds' piece points that out too, but this idea that somehow, you know, that there was no rule of law in the South, it was just rule of men, that would be akin to fascism, of course, but that's not what you had in the South. It's not what you had at all in the South. And Marshall, I think, hammers that to pieces with this one little piece that we ran on Wednesday, Confederate Case Law, the Rule of Law, Not of Men, and I would recommend everyone read that piece. On Thursday, we ran a piece by John Marcourt, our resident Southerner in Japan. John told me the other day he just celebrated his birthday, I can't remember exact age, but he's in his late 80s now, and so John's out there in Japan, trying to keep the Southern tradition alive over there. Wonderful man. He actually came to one of our conferences in Charleston, and flew all the way across the world to come to one of our conferences in Charleston, and it was just a great honor to have John come out. He's a very nice man. Served in World War II, here's a guy again. Who, of course, serving in the Pacific Theater, but here's a guy that was fighting, you know, the fascists and the emperor there in Japan. Loves the South and very pro South, but of course, you know, he's secretly, I would guess, you know, of course, to the left, he secretly harbors, you know, an infatuation with these horrible governments. But here he wrote this wonderful little piece, Furl That Banner, and it was based on a poem of the same. A Catholic priest wrote this poem, Furl That Banner, in the years after the war was over. And, of course, Jack gets into the current political climate. One thing he says, you know, he talks about how this particular poem advocated furling the Confederate flag, but not for the reasons that the politically correct crowd wants you to furl the flag today. And that is why the piece is so interesting, because there was some discussion after the war. Should we have Confederate symbols? Should we have Confederate monuments? Lee was against it in 1866. It's often held up, well, look, Robert E. Lee was against these things. Robert E. Lee was against those things because he understood the political climate of the time. He understood that having these things was very dangerous. In 1866, the South was still occupied by the United States Army. And there were all kinds of instances where Southerners were being abused by the Army after the war was over. And so he didn't want to draw attention to anything else that could be used against Southerners as a way of harming the South. But you did see people start, putting these things, putting up, erecting monuments. In Columbus, Georgia, in the cemetery there, they erected a wooden monument for the Confederate dead. And that was the goal. It was, you know, relief organizations, getting people limbs who had lost an arm or a leg in the war, relief for widows and these type of things for soldiers who had been killed in the war. But this particular poem, the Furl That Banner, it was actually entitled The Conquered Banner, where he talked about why the flag should be furled. And he said this: furl that banner softly, slowly, treat it gently, it is holy, for it droops above the dead. And that was his point. Here we had this sacred flag. It is holy. It's a holy flag because of the dead that served under it, because of the men who were killed under it. And that flag, I mean, was seen as a symbol of defiance, seen as a symbol of honor and patriotism for large numbers of Southerners throughout its history. And it's only been distorted by a few groups who want to use it for nefarious purposes and in ways that it was never intended to be used, that it's had this this awful connotation to it. But for most Southerners who support that flag, it has nothing to do with that. This is a flag of honor to them, a flag of, as it says in this poem, it is holy. It's holy. It's a symbol of freedom, of defiance. And if we're going to say, well, we need to value political discourse on both sides, what about the people that are saying that? Do they not matter anymore? Well, obviously to many on the left, and even some neoconservatives, they don't. They don't matter. These people that say, look, I support that flag, not for any of the reasons you're saying, but because it is a holy flag to me. It means defiance. It means patriotism. It means freedom. It means liberty to me. So symbols can mean things. And so should we just take a symbol down because some people don't like it? Where is the principle of liberty and freedom in that particular regard? Where is that? Where has that American principle gone, if that's what we're going to do? The object of free speech is to protect speech you don't like, not that you do like. That was the ideal all along. And of course, showing symbols is a form of speech. You protect those things. Even when you don't like it, you protect it. Because somebody may not like what you're saying either, and you don't want to be silenced. But this is where the left has become fascist in that way. And the Confederacy never was. In fact, on Friday, we ran a piece by Ryan Walters entitled Defending the Confederacy, where he gets into some of the things that I think that people forget about the Confederacy. And I did my own podcast on the Confederate Constitution and how it has some valuable lessons in it for American government, even to this day, if you just want to be a real academic and have an open mind about some things. There were some things in the Confederate Constitution that were better than the U.S. Constitution. And Orion points these things out, and I think does a nice job of that. And of course, just saying you're going to defend the Confederacy in any ways, I mean, is going to be almost sacrilegious today. But as he points out in this piece, you know, the Confederacy was fighting for Jeffersonian principles in many ways when it comes to the ideas of government. And so he points out some of these points. Number one, the states were greatly strengthened and better protected against federal encroachment. And he talks about how the states actually had impeachment. Through the legislatures, they could impeach federal officials, remove them. A judge, some other officer, they could get rid of these people if they were abusing power, and that was a valuable tool to curtail unconstitutional government. Protective tariffs were outlawed, so were federally funded internal improvements. Subsidies essentially were gotten rid of. Spending was strictly controlled. The president had a line item veto. The idea that every appropriation had to be spelled out in the and the bill was very important. You had, now, one thing he does say here, the earmarks, the practice of earmarks, we distort what that term actually is. He's talking about pork. Pork was eliminated because the president could line on and veto things. But earmarks are actually essential because they are specifically outlined spending bills in a bill itself. So earmarks are important. Everything should be earmarked. You spend a dollar, it should be told where that dollar is going in your budget, but we don't. We have omnibus bills, which just block large numbers of money to something, and you spend it however you want. So earmarks are actually important and should be there. And of course, he mentions the president only had a six-year term. It was more difficult to add states and these type of things. So it protected the integrity of the ballot and the inborn corruption therein. So no person of foreign birth shall be allowed to vote for any officer, civil, political, state, or civil or political, state or federal. So no non-citizens were allowed to vote in the Confederate Constitution. And you know, he says, you know, setting slavery and presentism aside, because of course the Confederate Constitution did have different protections for slavery. But if we want to be, you know, real open-minded and say, well, yeah, I mean, we're not going to like that, but aren't there some things in the Constitution that were better than the U.S. Constitution? Can't we look at these things as people who believe in limited government and self-government and say, well, these things would benefit the United States today? Of course you can, but of course that's not the point of the current pogroms against all things Southern. This is just a way to get rid of that defiant tradition that's out there, and it's an attack on traditional Americans, so to speak, in traditional American history. So that's the point. It's a cultural Marxist approach, the leveling of society, that all cultures and groups are equal in terms of what they bring to the table in their traditions and customs and things like that. And so, you know, there's no differences in cultures or traditions or society. And I think that's the real danger in all of this, that the South does have a valuable tradition. There are things in it, as we talk about in the podcast over and over, things in it that would help Americans, would help modern American society. And there's the South, as I've said on this podcast, is America. So over and over again, the Southern tradition is the American tradition. But what's happening nowadays is the attempt to get rid of that entirely. And Southern symbols are just the start. As we've said, you know, other symbols are going to come under attack. Even the founding generation are going to come under attack. It's just a matter of time, because the point is not just to get rid of Southern symbols, but to get rid of the entire American tradition that is based on. Until next time, good day.